But surely it's common practice to contact the chairperson of the Leaseholders Association, says Britt Marie with consternation. It isn't a Leaseholders Association yet, Mum sighs. But it will be. And that is what the landlord's accountant wants to come and talk about today. He says they're finally willing to convert our rental contracts into leaseholds. That's what I've been trying to tell you. As soon as I'd hung up the phone after talking to him, I contacted you. And then you woke up the whole house, and now here we are. What more do you want me to do, Britt Marie? What sort of nonsense is that, coming here on a Saturday? Surely one doesn't have meetings like this on a Saturday. Surely one doesn't, Ulrika. Do you think one does? Probably you do, Ulrika. Mum massages her temples. Britt Marie inhales and exhales fairly demonstratively and turns to Leonard and Maud and Alf for support. Maud tries to smile encouragingly. Leonard offers Britt Marie a shot of coffee while they're waiting. Alf looks as if he's now approaching his usual level of ill humour.
Well, we can't have the meeting without Kent, Britt Marie splutters.
No, of course, only if Kent can make it back, Mum agrees exhaustedly. Why don't you try calling him again?
His plane hasn't landed yet. He's actually on a business trip, Ulrika.
Alf grunts something behind them. Britt Marie spins round. Alf pushes his hands into his jacket pockets and grunts something again. Sorry, say Mum and Britt Marie at the same time, but in diametrically opposed tones of voice.
I'm just bloody saying that I sent Kent a text 20 minutes ago when you started making a bloody racket about this, and he got back to tell me he's on his bloody way, says Alf, and then adds, the idiot wouldn't miss this for all the tea in China.
Britt Marie seems not to hear the last bit. She brushes invisible dust from her skirt and folds her hands and gives Alf a superior glance, because she knows quite clearly that it's impossible for Kent to be on his way here, because in fact his plane hasn't landed yet, and in fact he's on a business trip. But then there comes the sound of the door slamming on the ground floor, and Kent's footsteps. You can tell they're Kent's because someone is screaming German into a telephone the way Nazis speak in American films.
Jan Klaus, ja, we will discuss this in Frankfurt.
Britt Marie immediately sets off down the stairs to meet him and tell him about the impudence that's been impudent enough to take place here in his absence. George comes out of the kitchen behind Mum, wearing leggings, shorts, a very green jumper, and an even greener apron. He gives them an amused look while holding a smoking frying pan.
Anyone want some breakfast? I've made eggs.
He looks as if he's going to add that there are also some newly bought protein bars on offer, but seems to change his mind when he realises they may run out.
I've brought some biscuits,
says Maud expansively, giving Elsa the whole tin and patting her tenderly on the cheek.
You have that. I can get some more, she whispers and walks into their flat. Is there coffee?
Asks Leonard nervously, having another shot of standby coffee as he follows her. Kent strides up the stairs and appears in the doorway. He is wearing jeans and an expensive jacket. Elsa knows that because Kent usually tells her how much his clothes cost, as if he's awarding points in the final of the Eurovision Song Contest. Britt Marie hurries along behind him, mumbling repeatedly,
the rudeness, the sheer rudeness of not calling you, of just calling any old person. Isn't that just so rude? Things can't be allowed to go on like this, Kent.
Kent doesn't really acknowledge his wife's raving, but points dramatically at Elsa's mum.
I want to know exactly what the accountant said when he called.
But before Mum has time to say anything, Britt Marie brushes off some invisible dust from Kent's arm and whispers to him in a radically changed tone of voice.
Maybe you should go down first and change your shirt, Kent.
Please, Britt Marie, we're doing business here, Kent says dismissively, more or less like Elsa when Mum wants her to wear something green.
She looks crestfallen.
I can throw it in the machine. Come along, Kent. There are freshly ironed shirts in your wardrobe. You really can't be wearing a wrinkly shirt when the accountant comes, Kent. What will the accountant think of us then? Will he think we can't iron our shirts?
She laughs nervously. Mum opens her mouth to try to say something again, but Kent catches sight of George.
Ah, you've got eggs!
Kent bursts out enthusiastically. George nods with satisfaction.
Kent immediately darts past Mum into the hall. Britt Marie hurries after him with a frown. When she passes Mum, Britt Marie looks bothered as she lets slip, "Oh, well, when one is busy with a career like you are, Ulrika, there's no time to clean, of course not." Even though every millimetre of the flat is in perfect order. Mum ties the sash of her dressing gown round her a little tighter and says with a deeply controlled sigh, "Just come on in, all of you. Make yourselves at home." Elsa dives into her room and changes out of her pyjamas into jeans as quick as she can, so she can run down and check on the worst in the cellar while everyone is busy up here. Kent interrogates Mum in the kitchen about the accountant, and Britt Marie echoes him with an "hmm" after every other word. The only one who stays in the hall is Alf. Elsa sticks her thumbs in her jean pockets and pokes her toes against the edge of the threshold, trying to avoid looking him in the eye.
"Thanks for not saying anything about the..."
she starts to say, but she stops herself before she has to say "worse." Alf shakes his head grumpily.
"You shouldn't have rushed off like that. If you've taken that animal on, you have to bloody shoulder your responsibility for it, even if you're a kid."
"I'm not a bloody kid," snaps Elsa.
"So quit behaving like one, then."
"Touché," Elsa whispers at the threshold.
"The animal is in the storage unit. I've put up some sheets of plywood so people can't see inside. Told it to keep its mouth shut.
I think it got the point, but you have to find a better hiding place. People will find it sooner or later," says Alf.
Elsa understands that when he says people, he means Britt Marie, and she knows he's right. She has a terribly bad conscience about abandoning the worst yesterday. Alf could have called the police, and they would have shot it. Elsa abandoned it like Granny abandoned Mum, and this scares her more than any nightmares.
"What are they talking about?"
she asks Alf, with a nod towards the kitchen to shake off the thought. Alf snorts.
"The bloody leaseholds."
"What does it mean?"
"Jesus, I can't stand here explaining everything," he groans. "The difference between a rental contract and a leasehold in a blo-"
"I know what a bloody leasehold is. I'm not bloody thick," says Elsa.
"Why are you asking then?" says Alf defensively.
"I'm asking what it means. Why are they all talking about it?"
Elsa clarifies, in the way one clarifies things without being very clear at all.
"Kent has been going on about these sodding leaseholds ever since he moved back in. He won't be satisfied until he can wipe his arse with the money he shat out first," explains Alf, in the manner of one who doesn't know very many seven-year-olds. "At first, Elsa is going to ask what Alf meant when he said that Kent moved back in, but she decides to take one thing at a time."
"Won't we all make money? You and Mum and George and all of us?"
"If we sell the flats and move, yeah,"
grunts Alf. Elsa ponders. Alf creaks his leather jacket.
"And that's what Kent wants, the bastard. He's always wanted to move out of here."
That is why she's having all these nightmares, she realizes, because if the creatures from the land of Almost Awake turn up in the house now, then maybe the house will start to become a part of the land of Almost Awake, and if they all want to sell their flats, then
we won't be escaping Miamis. We'll be leaving of our own free will," says Elsa out loud to herself.
"What?"
"Nothing," mumbles Elsa.
The door slamming at the bottom of the house echoes through the stairwell. Then discreet footsteps heading up. It's the accountant. Britt Marie drowns out Kent's voice in the kitchen. She doesn't get any response from Kent insofar as the shirt change goes, so she compensates with a lot of indignation about other things. There is a rich supply of such topics. It's difficult for her to decide which is most upsetting, of course, but she has time to run through several matters, including her threat to call the police if Elsa's mum doesn't immediately move Granny's car from Britt Marie's space in the garage, and also that Britt Marie will make the police break the lock of the pram that's still chained up by the entrance, and that she won't hesitate to put pressure on the landlord to put up cameras on the stairs so they can stop the vile malpractice of people coming and going as they please, and putting up notices without first informing the head of information. She's interrupted
by the very short man with the very friendly face now standing in the doorway, knocking tentatively against the doorframe.
"I'm the accountant," he says amicably.
And when he catches sight of Elsa, he winks at her, as if they share a secret. Or at least Elsa thinks that's what he means. Kent steps authoritatively out of the kitchen with his hands on his hips over his overcoat and looks the accountant up and down.
"Well, well. What about these leaseholds, then?" he demands at once. "What price per square meter are you offering?"
Britt Marie storms out of the kitchen from behind and points at the accountant accusingly.
"How did you get in?"
"The door was open," says the accountant amicably. Kent breaks in impatiently.
"So about the leaseholds, what's your price?"
The accountant points amicably at his briefcase and makes an amicable gesture towards the kitchen.
"Should we sit down, perhaps?" "There's coffee," Leonard says expansively.
"And biscuits," Maud says with a nod.
"And eggs,"
George hollers from the kitchen.
"Please, excuse the mess. They're all so preoccupied with their careers in this family," says Britt Marie well-meaningly.
Mum does her absolute best to pretend she didn't hear that. As they all head into the kitchen, Britt Marie stops, turns to Elsa, and clasps her hands together.
"You do understand, dear. I would obviously never ever think you and your grandmother's friends had anything to do with junkies. Obviously, I'm not to know if the gentleman who was looking for you yesterday took drugs or not. That's not at all what I mean to say."
Elsa gawks at her, puzzled.
"What? What friends? Who was asking for me yesterday?"
She almost asks.
"Was it Wolfhart?"
And then stops herself because she can't imagine how Britt Marie could possibly know that Wolfhart is her friend.
"Your friend, who was here looking for you yesterday, the one I jettisoned from the premises. There's a smoking man on the stairs, you can tell him that. That is not how we behave in this leaseholders association. I understand that you and your granny have very curious acquaintances, but rules apply to everyone, they really do."
She straightens an invisible wrinkle in her skirt and clasps her hands on her stomach before continuing.
"You know who I mean. He was very slim and stood here smoking on the stairs. He was looking for a child, a family friend, he said, and then he described you. He looked exceedingly unpleasant, actually, so I told him that in this leaseholders association we do not allow smoking indoors."
Elsa's heart shrinks, consumes all the oxygen in her body. She has to hold on to the doorframe to stop herself collapsing. No one sees her, not even Alf, but she understands what's about to happen in this adventure now. Because every fairy tale has a dragon. Chapter 19. Sponge Cake Mix. Fairy tales from Miamis tell of an infinite number of ways to defeat a dragon. But if this dragon is a shadow, the most evil kind of being one can possibly imagine, and yet it looks like a human, then what? Elsa doubts that even Wolfhart could defeat something like that, even while he was the most renowned warrior in the land of Almost Awake. And now, when he's afraid of snot and can't wash away the thought of blood from his own fingers. Elsa doesn't know anything about the shadow, only that she has seen it twice, the first time at the Undertaker's, and then from the bus that day on her way to school, and that she's dreamed of it, and now it's come to the house looking for her. And there's no coincidence in Miamis. In fairy tales, everything is always exactly as it's meant to be. So this must have been what Granny meant by, "Protect your castle, protect your friends." Elsa only wishes that Granny had given her an army to do it with. She waits until late at night, when it's dark enough for a child and a worse to pass unseen under Britt Marie's balcony, before she goes down to the cellar. George is out jogging. Mum is still out preparing everything for tomorrow. Since the meeting with the accountant this morning, she's been talking endlessly on the telephone with the whale woman from the undertakers and the florist and the vicar, and then with the hospital and the vicar again. Elsa has been sitting in her room, reading Spider-Man, doing her best not to think of tomorrow. It hasn't gone very well. She brings the worse, some biscuits she got from Maud, and once the contents have been mopped up, has to snatch back the tin so quickly that she almost gets an incisor manicure.
Granny always said that worse saliva was bloody hard to wash off, and Elsa is planning to give the tin back to Maud. But the worse, who in all ways is a typical worse, rummages round quite ravenously in her backpack, apparently having considerable difficulty understanding how she could have come down with just one paltry tin for it.
"I'll try and get you some more biscuits, but for now, you're going to have to eat this."
She opens a thermos.
"This is sponge cake mix. I don't know how to mix it properly, though,"
she mumbles apologetically.
"I found it in the cupboard in the kitchen, and it said, 'Ready sponge cake mix' on the packet, but it was only powder, so I added water. It's more like gunk than proper mix."
The worse looks sceptical, but its towel-sized tongue immediately licks all the gunk out of the thermos anyway, just to be on the safe side. An insanely flexible tongue is one of the most prominent superpowers of worses.
"There's been a man here looking for me,"
whispers Elsa into its ear, trying to sound brave.
"I think he's one of the shadows. We have to be on our guard."
The worse buffets its nose against her throat. She throws her arms round it and feels the taut muscles under its fur. It tries to seem playful, but she understands that it's doing what worses do best, preparing for battle. She loves it for that.
"I don't know where it comes from. Granny never told me about those kinds of dragons."
The worse buffets her throat again and looks at her with large, empathic eyes. It seems to be wishing it could tell her everything. Elsa wishes Wolfheart was here. She rang his door just now, but there was no answer. She didn't want to call out in case Brit Marie smelled a rat, but she made a loud sniffing sound through the letterbox to clearly signal she was about to sneeze the kind of sticky sneeze that instantly covers everything in camouflage paint. It had no effect.
"Wolfheart has disappeared,"
she finally admits to the worse. Elsa tries to be brave. It goes quite well while they're walking through the cellar, and it's quite okay while they go up the cellar stairs. But when they're standing in the vestibule, inside the main door, she feels the smell of tobacco smoke, the same kind of tobacco that Granny used to smoke, and a lingering fear from her nightmare paralyzes her. Her shoes weigh 1,000 tons. Her head thumps as if something has worked itself loose and is rattling around in there. It's strange how quickly the significance of a certain smell can change, depending on what path it decides to take through the brain. It's strange how close love and fear live to each other. She tells herself she's just imagining it, but it doesn't help. The worse stands patiently next to her, but her shoes won't budge. A newspaper blows past outside the window. It's the kind of newspaper you get through the letterbox even if you have a "No junk mail, please" sticker on the door. It reminds Elsa of Granny. She stands there, still frozen, and the newspaper makes her angry, because it's Granny who put her in this situation. It's all Granny's fault. Elsa remembers the time Granny called the newspaper office and gave them a roasting for putting it in her letterbox, even though she had a "No junk mail ever, thanks" message in surprisingly clear letters on the door. Elsa had thought a lot about why it said "thanks," because Elsa's mum always said that if one can't say thanks as if one means it, one may as well not bother. And it didn't sound like the note on Granny's door meant it at all. But the people answering the telephone at the office of the newspaper told Granny their newspaper wasn't in the business of advertising, but in fact social information, which can be put in people's letterboxes irrespective of whether people thank them not to do so. Granny had demanded to know who owned the company that produced the newspaper, and after that, she demanded a word with him. The people at the other end of the telephone line said that surely Granny could understand that the owner did not have time for this sort of nonsense. Of course, they shouldn't have said that, because there were actually an awful lot of things that Granny didn't surely understand at all. Also, unlike the man who owned the company that produced the free newspaper, she had a lot of spare time. "Never mess with someone who has more spare time than you do," Granny used to say. Elsa used to translate that as, "Never mess with someone who's perky for her age." In the following days, Granny had picked up Elsa as usual from school, and then they'd patrolled the block with yellow IKEA carrier bags, ringing all the doorbells. People seem to find it a bit weird, especially as everyone knows you're actually not allowed to take those yellow IKEA bags from the store.
If anyone started asking too many questions, Granny just said they were from an environmental organization collecting recyclable paper. And then people didn't dare make any more fuss.
People are afraid of environmental organizations. They think we'll storm the flat and accuse them of not handling their waste properly. They watch too many films,
Granny had explained as she and Elsa loaded the stuffed carrier bags into Renault. Elsa never quite understood what kinds of films Granny had seen and where that sort of thing would ever happen. She did know that Granny hated environmental organizations, which she called panda fascists. Whatever the case, you're actually not supposed to take those yellow carrier bags out of the store. Of course, Granny had just shrugged it off.
I never stole the bags, I just haven't given them back yet, she muttered,
and gave Elsa a thick felt-tip pen to write with. And then Elsa said she wanted at least 4 tubs of Ben and Jerry's New York Super Fudge Chunk for this. And then Granny said, 1. And then Elsa said, 3. And then Granny said, 2. And then Elsa said, 3, or I'm telling Mum. And then Granny yelled,
I'm not negotiating with terrorists.
And then Elsa pointed out that if one looked up terrorist on Wikipedia, there were quite a lot of things in the definition of the word that applied to Granny, but not a single one that applied to Elsa.
The goal of terrorists is to create chaos, and Mum says that's exactly what you're busy doing all day long, said Elsa.
And then Granny had agreed to give Elsa 4 tubs, if she just took the felt-tip pen and promised to keep her mouth shut. And so that's what Elsa did. Late into the night, she'd sat in the dark in Renault, on the other side of town, on guard duty, while Granny ran in and out of houses' entrances with her yellow IKEA carrier bags. The next morning, the man who owned the company that produced the free newspaper was woken by the neighbours ringing his doorbell, very upset because somebody had apparently filled the lift with hundreds of copies of the free newspaper. Every letterbox was stuffed full of them, and every square centimetre of the large glass entrance door had been covered in taped-up copies, and outside every flat, great tottering piles had been left that collapsed and fell down the stairs when the doors were opened. On every copy of the newspaper, the man's name had been written in large, neat, felt-tip letters, and just below,
complimentary social information for your reading pleasure.
On the way back home, Granny and Elsa had stopped at a petrol station to buy ice cream. A few days later, Granny called the newspaper once again, and after that, she never received a single free copy.
Coming in or going?
Alf's voice cuts through the gloom of the stairwell like laughter. Elsa turns round and instinctively wants to throw herself into his arms, but she stops herself because she realizes he would probably dislike that almost as much as Wolfheart would. He shoves his hands in his pockets with a creak of his leather jacket and nod sharply at the door.
In or out, there are others apart from you who fancy a bloody walk, you know?
Elsa and the worst give him blank looks. He mutters something and goes past them and opens the door. Immediately they fall into step, just behind him, though he never asks for their company. When they've gone round the corner of the house, out of sight from Britt Marie's balcony, the worse backs into a bush and growls at them as politely as can be expected of a worse in need of a bit of concentration. They turn away. Alf looks unamused in every possible way by his uninvited company. Elsa clears her throat and tries to think of something to make small talk about, to keep him there.
The car's going well, is it?
She bursts out, because that's what she's heard her dad say when he's at a loss. Alf nods. Nothing more. Elsa breathes loudly.
What did the accountant say at the meeting?
She asks instead, in the hope that this might make Alf as upset and talkative as he gets at the residence meetings. It's easier to get people talking about things they dislike than things they like, Elsa has noticed. And it's easier not to get frightened of shadows in the dark when someone is talking whatever they're talking about.
That accountant bastard said the owners had decided to sell the bloody flats to the Residents Association bastards if everyone in the house agrees.
Elsa observes the corners of his mouth. He almost seems to be smiling.
Is that funny? Are you living in the same house as me? They'll solve the Israel-Palestine conflict before people in this house agree about anything. Will anyone want to sell their flat if the house is converted to leaseholds? She asks.
The corners of Alf's mouth flatten into a more Alf-like shape.
I don't know about wanting. Most will bloody well have to.
Why?
Good area. Expensive bloody flats. Most people in the house won't be able to afford that kind of bastard bank loan.
Will you have to move?
Probably.
Mum and George and me, then?
I don't bloody know, do I?
Elsa thinks.
What about Maud and Leonard?
You've got a bloody lot of questions.
Well, what are you doing out here if you don't want to talk?
Alf's jacket creaks towards the worse in the bush.
I was only going for a bloody walk. No one bloody invited you and that thing.
It's just insane how much you swear. Did anyone ever tell you that? My dad says it's a sign of a bad vocabulary.
Alf glares at her and shoves his hands in his pockets.
Maud and Leonard will have to move. And the girl and her kid on the first bloody floor as well, most likely. The psychologist bastard you went to yesterday, I don't know, she probably has a hell of a lot of money.
He stops himself, summons some kind of self-restraint.
That lady, she probably has a heck of a lot of money, that woman, he self-corrects.
What did my granny think about it?
There's another brief twitch at the corners of Alf's mouth.
Usually the diametric opposite of what Brit Marie thought.
Elsa draws miniature snow angels with her shoe.
Maybe it'll be good. If there are leaseholds, then maybe everyone can move somewhere good, she says tentatively.
It's good here. We're doing fine here. This is our bloody home.
Elsa doesn't protest. This is her home too. Another free newspaper tumbles past in the wind. It gets caught on her foot for a moment before it tears itself free and keeps rolling like an angry little starfish. It makes Elsa furious again, gets her thinking about how much Granny was willing to fight to get them to stop putting newspapers in her letterbox. It makes Elsa furious because it was a typical Granny thing to do, because Granny was only doing it for Elsa's sake. Granny things were always like that, for Elsa's sake. Because Granny actually liked those newspapers. She used to stuff them into her shoes when it had been raining. But one day when Elsa read on the internet how many trees it took to make just one edition of a newspaper, she put up,
"No junk mail ever, thanks."
Notices on both Mum and Granny's doors, because Elsa is a big fan of the environment. The newspapers kept coming, and when Elsa called the company, they just laughed at her. And they shouldn't have done that, because no one laughs at Granny's grandchild. Granny hated the environment, but she was the kind of person you brought along when you were going to war. So she became a terrorist for Elsa's sake. Elsa is furious at Granny for that, in fact, because Elsa wants to be furious at Granny. For everything else. For the lies, and for abandoning Mum, and for dying. But it's impossible to stay angry at someone who's prepared to turn terrorist for the sake of her grandchild. And it makes Elsa furious that she can't be furious. She can't even be angry at Granny in a normal way. Not even that is normal about Granny. She stands in silence next to Alf and blinks until her head hurts. Alf tries to look unconcerned, but Elsa notices that he's scanning the darkness, as if looking for someone. He watches their surroundings much like Wolfheart and the worse, as if he's also on guard duty. She squints and tries to fit him into Granny's life like a piece of a puzzle. She can't recall Granny ever talking very much about him, except that he never knew how to lift his feet, which was why the soles of his shoes were always so worn down.
How well did you know Granny? She asks.
The leather jacket creaks.
What do you mean, knew? We were bloody neighbours, that's all,
Alf answers evasively.
So what did you mean when you picked me up in the taxi when you said Granny would never have forgiven you if you'd left me there?
More creaking.
I didn't mean anything. Not a bloody... Nothing. I just happened to be in the area. Bloody...
He sounds frustrated. Elsa nods, pretending to understand in a way that Alf clearly doesn't appreciate at all.
Why are you here, then?
She asks, teasingly.
Why did you follow me outside? Shouldn't you be driving your taxi now or something?
You don't have a You don't have exclusive rights to taking walks, you know?
Sure, sure.
I can't let you and the mutt run loose here at night on your own. Your granny would have He interrupts himself, grunts, sighs. Your granny would never have forgiven me if something happened to you.
It looks as if he already regrets saying that.
Did you and Granny have an affair?
Elsa asks, after waiting for what seems a more than adequate length of time.
Alf looks like she just threw a yellow snowball in his face. Aren't you a bit young to know what that means?
There are loads of things I'm too young to know about, but I know about them anyway.
She clears her throat and carries on.
Once when I was small, Mum was going to explain what her work was because I'd asked Dad and he didn't really seem to know. And then Mum said she worked as an economist. And then I said, what? And then she said, I'll work out how much money the hospital has so we know what we can buy. And then I said, what, like in a shop? And then she said that, yeah, sort of like in a shop. And it wasn't hard to get it at all. And so really Dad was being a bit thick about it.
Alf checks his watch.
But then, anyway, I saw a TV series where two people had a shop. They were also having an affair, or at least I think they did. So now I get what it means, sort of thing. And I thought that was kind of how you and Granny knew each other. So, did you? Or didn't you?
Is that mutt done now, or what? Some of us have jobs to go to?
Alf mutters, which isn't much of an answer. He turns towards the bushes. Elsa scrutinizes him, thoughtfully.
I just thought you could be Granny's type, because you're a bit younger than she is, and she always flirted with policemen who were about your age. They were sort of too old to be policemen, but they were still policemen. Not that you're a policeman, I mean, but you're also old without being really old. Get what I mean?
Alf doesn't look like he really gets it, and he looks like he's got a bit of a migraine. The worse finishes, and the three of them head back inside, Elsa in the middle.
It's not a big army. But it's an army, thinks Elsa, and feels a little less afraid of the dark.
When they part ways in the cellar between the door to the garage and the door to the storage units, Elsa scrapes her shoe against the floor and asks Alf,
what was that music you were listening to in the car when you came to pick me up? Was it opera?
Holy Christ, enough questions!
I was only asking. Bloody,
yay, it was a bastard opera!
What language was it in?
Italian.
Can you talk Italian?
Yeah.
For real?
What other bloody way is there to know Italian?
But, like, fluently.
You have to find another hiding place for that thing, I told you, he says, gesturing at the worse,
clearly trying to change the subject.
People will find it sooner or later.
Do you know Italian or not?
I know enough to understand an opera. You got any other bastard questions?
What was that opera about in the car, then?
She persists. Alf pulls open the garage door.
Love. They're all about love. The whole lot.
He pronounces the word love a little as one would say words like white goods or two-inch screw.
Were you in love with my granny, then?
Elsa yells after him, but he's already slammed the door. She stays there, grinning. The worst does, too. She's almost sure about that, and it's much more difficult being afraid of shadows and the dark while grinning.
I think Alf is our friend now,
she whispers. The worse looks like it agrees.
We're going to need all the friends we can get, because Granny didn't tell me what happens in this fairy tale.
The worse snuggles up against her.
I miss Wolfheart,
Elsa whispers into its fur. Reluctantly, the worse seems to agree with that too.
Chapter 20. Clothes Shop.
Today's the day, and it starts with the most terrible night. Elsa wakes with her mouth wide open, but her scream fills her head rather than the room. She roars silently and reaches out with her hand to toss aside the bedclothes, but they're already on the floor. She walks into the flat,
It smells of eggs. George smiles carefully at her from the kitchen. She doesn't smile back. He looks upset. She doesn't care. She has a shower so hot her skin feels as if it's about to come away from her flesh like clementine peel. Walks out into the flat. Mum left home hours ago. She's gone to fix everything because that is what Mum does. George calls out something behind Elsa, but she neither listens nor answers. She puts on the clothes that Mum has put out for her and crosses the landing, locking the front door behind her. Granny's flat smells wrong. It smells clean. The towers of removal boxes throw shadows across the hall like monuments to everything that is now absent. She stands inside the door, incapable of going any further inside. She was here last night, but it's more difficult by daylight. It's harder work remembering things when the sun is forcing its way in through the blinds. Cloud animals soar past in the sky. It's a beautiful morning, but a terrible day. Elsa's skin is still burning after her shower. It makes her think of Granny, because Granny's shower hadn't worked in over a year, and instead of calling the landlord and asking him to sort out the problem, she just used Mum and George's shower. And sometimes she forgot to do up her dressing gown when she went back through the flat. And sometimes she forgot her dressing gown altogether. Once, Mum shouted at her for what must have been 15 minutes because she didn't show any respect about George also living in Mum and Elsa's flat. But that was soon after Elsa had started reading the collected works of Charles Dickens. Granny was not much use at reading books, so Elsa used to read them to her while they were driving Renault, because Elsa wanted to have someone she could discuss them with afterwards. Especially A Christmas Carol, which Elsa had read several times, because Granny liked Christmas stories. So when Mum said that thing about how Granny shouldn't run about naked in the flat out of respect to George, then Granny, still naked, turned to George and said, "What's all this respect rubbish? You're cohabiting with my daughter, for goodness sake." And then Granny bowed very deeply and very nakedly and added ceremoniously, "I am the spirit of future Christmases, George." Mum was very angry at Granny about that, but she tried not to show it for Elsa's sake. So for Mum's sake, Elsa tried not to show how proud she was of Granny for being able to quote Charles Dickens. Elsa goes into the flat without taking off her shoes. She's wearing the kind of shoes that scratch the parquet flooring, so Mum has told her she can't wear them inside. But it doesn't matter in Granny's place because the floor already looks as if someone went skating on it. Partly because it's old and partly because Granny actually once went skating on it. Elsa opens the door of the big wardrobe. The worse licks her face. It smells of protein bars and sponge cake mix. Elsa had just gone to bed last night when she realized that Mum would most likely send George down to the cellar storage unit today to get the spare chairs, because everyone is coming here afterwards for coffee. Because today is the day, and everyone drinks coffee somewhere after days like this. Mum and George's cellar unit is next to Granny's unit, and it's the only storage unit you can see the worst from now that Alf has put up the plywood sheets. So Elsa sneaked down in the night, unable to decide whether she was more afraid of shadows or ghosts or Brit Marie, and brought the worse upstairs.
"There would be more space to hide you in here if Granny wasn't dead," says Elsa apologetically, because then the wardrobe wouldn't have stopped growing. "Then again, if Granny hadn't died, you wouldn't need to hide in the first place."
The worse licks her face again and squeezes its head through the opening and looks for her backpack. Elsa runs to fetch it from the hall and pulls out 3 tins of dreams and 1 litre of milk.
"Maud left them with Mum last night," Elsa explains,
but when the worse immediately starts snuffling her hands as if about to eat the biscuits with the tin still round them, she raises an admonishing forefinger.
"You can only have 2 tins. One is for ammunition."
The worse barks at her a bit about that, but in the end recognizes its poor bargaining position and only polishes off 2 of the tins and 1/2 of the 3rd. It is a worse, after all, and these are biscuits. Elsa takes the milk and goes looking for her moo gun. She's a bit slow on the uptake today. Because she hasn't had any nightmares in years, she's only realizing now that she may need it. The first time the shadow came to her in the nightmare, she tried to shake it all off the next morning, as you do. tried to persuade herself that it was only a nightmare. But she should have known better, because everyone who has ever been in the land of almost awake knows better. So last night, when she had the same dream, she realized where she had to go to fight the nightmares, to reclaim her nights from them.
"Meravis!"
she calls out firmly to the worse when it comes out of one of Granny's smaller wardrobes, followed by an unnameable jumble of things that Mum has not yet had time to put into boxes.
"We have to go to Meravis,"
announces Elsa to the worse, waving her moo gun. Meravis, one of the kingdoms adjoining Miamis, is the smallest principality in the land of Almost Awake, and for that reason, almost forgotten. When children in the land of Almost Awake are learning geography and have to reel off the names of the six kingdoms, Meravis is the one they always forget, even those who live there, because the Meravasians are incredibly humble, kindly, and cautious creatures who go to great lengths to avoid taking up unnecessary space or causing the slightest inconvenience. Yet they have a very important task, actually one of the most important tasks in a kingdom where imagination is the most important thing you can have. For it is in Meravis that the nightmare hunters are trained. Only smartasses in the real world who don't know any better would say something as idiotic as, "It was only a nightmare." There are no only nightmares. They're living creatures, dark, little clouds of insecurity and anguish that come sneaking between the houses when everyone is asleep, trying all the doors and windows to find some place to slip inside and start causing a commotion. And that is why there are nightmare hunters, and anyone who knows anything about anything knows one has to have a moo gun to chase a nightmare. Someone who doesn't know better might mistake a moo gun for a quite ordinary paintball gun customized by someone's granny with a milk carton at the side and a catapult glued to the top. Elsa, though, knows what she's got in her hands. She loads the carton with milk and puts a biscuit in the firing chamber in front of the rubber band on the biscuit gun. You can't kill a nightmare, but you can scare it. And there's nothing so feared by nightmares as milk and biscuits. Just as she's starting to feel more confident, though, she's startled by the doorbell, and to the infinite chagrin of the worse, she accidentally fires loads of milk at it, but no biscuit, and it scurries off in a huff. For a moment, she wonders how a nightmare can be ringing the doorbell, but it's only George. He looks upset. She doesn't care.
I'm going down to pick up the spare chairs in the cellar storage, he says, and tries to smile at her, like stepdads do on days when they have an extra strong sense of being sidelined.
Elsa shrugs and slams the door in his face. The worse has reappeared, so she climbs onto its back and peers out of the spy hole to see George lingering there for what must be a minute, looking upset. Elsa hates him for that. Mum always tells Elsa that George just wants her to like him because he cares. As if Elsa doesn't get that. She knows he cares, and that's why she can't like him. Not because she wouldn't like him if she tried, but rather because she knows she definitely would.
Because everyone likes George.
It's his superpower. And she knows that in this case, she'll only be disappointed when Harfi is born, and George forgets she exists. It's better not to like him from the start. If you don't like people, they can't hurt you. Almost 8-year-olds, who are often described as different, learn that very quickly. She jumps down from the worse's back. The worse closes its jaws round the moo gun and gently but firmly takes it away from her, then shambles off and puts it on a stool out of reach of her trigger finger. But it avoids eating the biscuit, which, as anyone who understands just how much worses love biscuits, is a significant sign of respect for Elsa. There's another ring at the door. Elsa throws it open and is just about to snap impatiently at George when she realizes just in time that it's not George. There's a silence lasting for probably half a dozen eternities.
"Hello, Elsa," says the woman in the black skirt, sounding a bit lost.
She's wearing jeans, not a black skirt today, admittedly, and she smells of mint and looks scared. She breathes so slowly that Elsa fears she's about to expire from a shortage of oxygen.
I'm very sorry I shouted at you in my office, she begins. They scrutinize each other's shoes.
It's cool,
Elsa manages to say at last. The corners of the woman's mouth vibrate gently.
I was a bit caught off guard when you came to the office. I don't get many people visiting me there. I'm not so good at visits.
Elsa nods guiltily without looking up from the woman's shoes.
It doesn't matter. Sorry for saying that about...
She whispers, unable to get out the last few words. The woman waves her hand dismissively.
It was my fault. It's difficult for me to talk about my family. Your grandmother tried to make me do it, but it only made me, well, angry.
Elsa pokes at the floor with the tip of her toe.
People drink wine to forget things that are hard, right?
Or to have the strength to remember, I think.
Elsa snuffles.
You're also broken, right? Like Wolfheart.
Broken in another way, maybe.
Couldn't you mend yourself, then?
You mean because I'm a psychologist?
Elsa nods.
Doesn't that work?
I don't think surgeons can operate on themselves. It's probably more or less the same thing.
Elsa nods again. For an instant, the woman in the jeans looks as if she's about to reach out towards her, but she stops herself and absentmindedly scratches the palm of her hand instead.
Your granny wrote in the letter that she wanted me to look after you, she whispers.
Elsa nods.
That's what she writes in all the letters, apparently.
You sound angry.
She didn't write any letters to me.
The woman reaches into a bag on the floor and gets something out.
I bought these Harry Potter books yesterday. I haven't had time to get very far yet, but, you know.
What made you change your mind?
I understand Harry Potter is important to you.
Harry Potter is important for everyone.
The skin around the woman's mouth cracks again. She takes another long, deep breath. Looks into Elsa's eyes and says,
I like him a lot, too. That's what I wanted to say. It's been a long time since I had such an amazing reading experience. You almost never do once you grow up. Things are at their peak when you're a child, and then it's all downhill from there. Well, because of the cynicism, I suppose. I just wanted to thank you for reminding me of how things used to be.
Those are more words than Elsa has ever heard the woman say without stuttering. The woman offers her what's in the bag. Elsa takes it. It's also a book. A fairy tale. The Brothers Lionheart by Astrid Lindgren. Elsa knows that because it's one of her favourite stories that doesn't come from the land of Almost Awake. She read it aloud to Granny many times while they were driving around in Renu. It's about Carl and Jonathan, who die and come to Nangi Yala, where they have to fight the tyrant, Tengil, and the dragon, Katla. The woman's gaze loses its footing again.
I used to read it to my boys when their granny died. I don't know if you've read it. You probably have.
Elsa shakes her head and holds the book tightly.
No,
she lies, because she's polite enough to know that if someone gives you a book, you owe that person the pretense that you haven't read it. The woman in jeans looks relieved. Then she takes such a deep breath that Elsa fears her wishbone is about to snap.
You know, you asked if we met at the hospital, your granny and I. After the tsunami, they had laid out all the dead bodies in a little square, so families and friends could look for their... After she found me there, in the square. I had been sitting there for, I don't know, several weeks, I think. She flew me home and she said I could live here until I knew where I was going.
Her lips open and close in turn as if they're electric.
I just stayed here, I just stayed.
Elsa looks down at her own shoes this time.
Are you coming today? She asks.
In the corner of her eyes she can see the woman shaking her head, as if she wants to run away again. I think your grandmother was very disappointed in me.
Maybe she was disappointed in you because you're so disappointed in yourself.
There's a choking sound in the woman's throat. It takes a while before Elsa understands it's probably laughter, as if that part of her throat had been in disuse and has just found the key to itself and flicked some old electrical switch.
You're really a very different little child, says the woman.
I'm not a little child. I'm almost 8.
Yes, sorry. You were a newborn when I moved in here. Newborn?
There's nothing wrong with being different. Granny said that only different people change the world.
Yes, sorry, I have to go. I just wanted to say sorry.
It's okay. Thanks for the book.
The woman's eyes hesitate, but she looks straight at Elsa again.
Has your friend come back? Wolf, what was it you called him?
Elsa shakes her head. There's something in the woman's eyes that actually looks like genuine concern.
He does that sometimes. Disappears. You shouldn't worry. He gets scared of people, disappears for a while, but he always comes back. He just needs time.
I think he needs help.
It's hard to help those who don't want to help themselves.
Someone who wants to help himself is possibly not the one who's most in need of other people's help,
Elsa objects. The woman nods without answering.
I have to go, she repeats.
Elsa wants to stop her, but she's already halfway down the stairs. She's almost disappeared on the floor below when Elsa leans over the railing, gathers her strength and calls out.
Did you find them? Did you find your boys in the square?
The woman stops, holds the banister very hard.
Yes.
Elsa bites her lip.
Do you believe in life after death?
The woman looks up at her.
That's a difficult question.
I mean, you know, do you believe in God?
Asks Elsa. Sometimes it's hard to believe in God, answers the woman.
Because you wonder why God didn't stop the tsunami?
Because I wonder why there are tsunamis at all.
Elsa nods.
I saw someone in a film once say, faith can move mountains.
Elsa goes on without knowing why, maybe mainly because she doesn't want to lose sight of the woman before she has time to ask the question she really wants to ask.
So I hear, says the woman.
Elsa shakes her head.
But you know, that's actually true, because it comes from Miamis, from a giant called Faith. She was so strong it was insane, and she could literally move mountains.
The woman looks as if she's trying to find a reason to disappear down the stairs. Elsa takes a quick breath.
Everyone says I may miss Granny now, but it'll pass. I'm not so sure.
The woman looks up at her again with her empathic eyes. Why not?
It hasn't passed for you.
The woman half closes her eyes. Maybe it's different.
How?
Your granny was old.
Not to me. I only knew her for 7 years, almost 8.
The woman doesn't answer. Elsa rubs her hands together like Wolfheart does.
You should come today,
Elsa calls out after her, but the woman has already disappeared. Elsa hears the door of her flat closing and then everything is silent until she hears Dad's voice from the door at the bottom. She collects herself and wipes her tears and forces the worst to hide in the wardrobe again with half of the Moo Gun ammunition as a bribe. Then she closes the door of Granny's flat without locking it and runs down the stairs. And a few moments later, she's lying in Audi with the seat reclined as far as it'll go, staring out of the glass ceiling. The cloud animals are soaring lower now. Dad is wearing a suit and is also silent. It feels strange because Dad hardly ever wears a suit, but today is the day.
Do you believe in God, Dad?
Asks Elsa, in the way that always catches him unaware like water balloons thrown from a balcony.
Elsa knows that because Granny loved water balloons and Dad learned never to walk right beneath her balcony.
I don't know, he answers.
Elsa hates him for not having an answer, but she loves him a bit for not lying. Audi stops outside a black steel gate. They sit for a while, waiting.
Am I like Granny?
Says Elsa, without taking her eyes off the sky.
You mean in physical appearance? Asks Dad, hesitantly.
No, like as a person, sighs Elsa.
Dad looks as if he's fighting his hesitation for a moment, like you do when you have daughters aged about 8. It's almost as if Elsa has just asked him to explain where babies come from, again.
You must stop saying like and sort of all the time. Only people with a bad vocabulary, he begins to say instead, because he can't stop himself, because that's the way he is. One of those who find it very important to say one of those and not one of them.
So bloody leave it then,
Elsa snaps, much more vehemently than she means to, because she's not in the mood for his corrections today. Usually it's their thing, correcting one another, their only thing. Dad has a word jar where Elsa puts difficult words she has learned, like concise and pretentious, or complex phrases like, my fridge is a taco sauce graveyard. And every time the jar is full, she gets a gift voucher for a book to download on the iPad. The word jar has financed the entire Harry Potter series for her, although she knows Dad is ridiculously dubious about Harry Potter, because Dad can't get his head round a story unless it's based on reality.
Sorry,
mumbles Elsa. Dad sinks into his seat. They compete at seeing who can feel most ashamed. Then he says, slightly less tentatively,
yes, you're very much like her. You've got all your best qualities from her and your mother.
Elsa doesn't answer because she doesn't know if that was the answer she wanted. Dad doesn't say anything either because he's unsure whether that was what he should have said. Elsa wants to tell him she wants to stay with him more. Every other weekend is not enough. She wants to yell at him that once Harvey comes along and is quite normal, George and Mum won't want to have Elsa at home anymore, because parents want normal children, not different children. And Harvey will stand next to Elsa and remind them of all the differences between them. She wants to yell that Granny was wrong, that different is not always good, because different is a mutation, and almost no one in X-Men has a family. She wants to yell out the whole thing, but she doesn't. Because she knows he'd never understand. And she knows he wouldn't want her to live with him and Lizette, because Lizette has her own children, undifferent children. Dad sits in silence like you do when you don't feel like wearing a suit. But just as Elsa opens Audi's door to jump out, he turns to her hesitantly and says in a low voice, but there are moments when I sincerely hope that not all your best traits come from Granny and Mum, Elsa. And then Elsa squeezes her eyes together tightly and puts her forehead against his shoulder and her fingers into her jacket pocket and spins the lid of the red felt-tip pen that he gave her when she was small so she could add her own punctuation marks, and which is still the best present he's ever given her, or anyone.
You gave me your words,
she whispers. He tries to blink his pride out of his eyes. She sees that. And she wants to tell him that she lied to him last Friday, that she was the one who sent the SMS from Mum's phone about how he didn't have to pick her up from school, but she doesn't want to disappoint him, so she stays quiet. Because you hardly ever disappoint anybody if you just stay quiet. All almost 8-year-olds know that. Dad kisses her hair. She raises her head and pretends to say in passing,
will you and Lizette have children?
I don't think so. Dad replies, sadly, as if it's quite self-evident.
Why not?
We have all the children we need. And it sounds as if he stops himself from saying, more than we need. Or at least, that's how it feels.
Is it because of me you don't want more children?
She asks, and hopes he'll say, no. Yes, he says.
Because I turned out different,
she whispers. He doesn't answer, and she doesn't wait. But just as she's about to slam the door of Audi from the outside, Dad reaches across the seat and catches her fingertips, and when she meets his eyes, he looks back tentatively, like he always does,
But then he whispers, "Because you turned out to be perfect." She's never heard him so non-tentative, and if she'd said that aloud, he would have told her that there's no such word. And she loves him for that. George stands by the gate looking sad. He's also wearing a suit. Elsa runs past him, and Mum catches hold of her, her mascara running, and Elsa presses her face against Harfi. Mum's dress smells of boutique. The cloud animals are flying low. And that's the day they bury Elsa's granny. Chapter 21. Candle Grease. There are storytellers in the land of Almost Awake who say we all have an inner voice, whispering to us what we must do, and all we must do is listen. Elsa has never really believed it because she doesn't like the thought of someone else having a voice inside her, and Granny always said that only psychologists and murderers have inner voices. Granny never liked proper psychology, though she really did try with the woman in the black skirt. But in spite of all, in a moment Elsa will hear a voice in her head as clear as a bell. It won't be whispering, it will be yelling. It will be yelling, "Run!" And Elsa will run for her life, with the shadow behind her. Of course she doesn't know that when she goes into the church. The quiet murmuring of hundreds of strangers rises towards the ceiling, like the hissing of a broken car stereo. The legions of smart-asses point at her and whisper. Their eyes are oppressive. She doesn't know who they are, and it makes her feel tricked. She doesn't want to share Granny with others. She doesn't want to be reminded of how Granny was her only friend, while Granny herself had hundreds of others. She concentrates hard on walking straight-backed through the crush, doesn't want them to see that she feels as if she's going to collapse any moment, and doesn't even have the strength to be upset any more. The church floor sucks at her feet. The coffin up there stings her eyes. The mightiest power of death is not that it can make people die, but that it can make the people left behind want to stop living, she thinks, without remembering where she heard that. On second thought, she decides it probably comes from the land of Almost Awake, although this seems unlikely when one considers what Granny thought about death. Death was Granny's nemesis. That's why she never wanted to talk about it. And that was also why she became a surgeon, to cause death as much aggravation as she could. But it might also come from Miplorus, realizes Elsa. Granny never wanted to ride to Miplorus when they were in the land of Almost Awake, but sometimes she did it anyway because of Elsa's nagging. And sometimes Elsa rode there on her own when Granny was at some inn in Miamis playing poker with a troll or arguing about wine with a snow angel. Miplorus is the most beautiful of all the kingdoms of the land of Almost Awake. The trees sing there. The grass massages the soles of your feet, and there's always a smell of fresh baked bread. The houses are so beautiful that to be on the safe side, you have to be sitting down when you look at them. But no one lives there. They're only used for storage. For Miplorus is where all fairy creatures bring their sorrow, and where all leftover sorrow is stored. For an eternity of all fairy tales. People in the real world always say when something terrible happens that the sadness and loss and aching pain of the heart will lessen as time passes. But it isn't true. Sorrow and loss are constant. But if we all had to go through our whole lives carrying them the whole time, we wouldn't be able to stand it. The sadness would paralyze us. So in the end, we just pack it into bags and find somewhere to leave it. That is what Miplorus is, a kingdom where lone storytelling travellers come slowly wandering from all directions, dragging unwieldy luggage full of sorrow, a place where they can put it down and go back to life. And when the travellers turn back, they do so with lighter steps, because Miplorus is constructed in such a way that irrespective of what direction you leave it, you always have the sun up ahead and the wind at your back. The Miplorusians gather up all the suitcases and sacks and bags of sorrow and carefully make a note of them in little pads. They scrupulously catalogue every kind of sadness and pining. Things are kept in very good order in Miplorus.
They have an extensive system of rules and impeccably clear areas of responsibility for all kinds of sorrows.
Bureaucratic bastards,
was what Granny called the Miplorigians, because of all the forms that have to be filled out nowadays by whoever is dropping off some sorrow or other. But you can't put up with this order when it comes to sorrow, say the Miplorigians. Miploris used to be the smallest kingdom in the land of Almost Awake, but after the war without end it became the biggest. That was why Granny didn't like riding there, because so many of the stores had her name on signs outside. And in Miploris people talk of inner voices, Elsa remembers now. Miplorigians believe that the inner voices are those of the dead, coming back to help their loved ones. Elsa is pulled back into the real world by Dad's gentle hand on her shoulder. She hears his voice whispering. You've arranged everything very nicely, Ulrika, to Mum. In the corner of her eye, she sees how Mum smiles and nods at the programs lying on the church pews, and then replies, Thanks for doing the programs. Lovely font. Elsa sits at the far end of the wooden pew at the front of the chapel, staring down into the floor until the mumbling dies down. The church is so packed that people are standing all along the walls. Many of them have insanely weird clothes, as if they've been playing outfit roulette with someone who can't read washing instruction tags. Elsa will put outfit roulette in the word jar, she thinks.